Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Dave James. Efforts at the State House to legalize sports betting continue. There are still two proposals being considered, but one of them passed the Ohio House last month. I'll talk to a sponsor of that legislation in just a moment. Courtesy of 10TV, Scott Light will review Governor Mike DeWine's work on the pandemic, and he'll also talk about the housing market with Michael Jones, president-elect of Columbus Realtors, and about the economy with Hannah Halbert, executive director of Policy Matters Ohio. In the second half hour, Ben Miller with Wellbeing Trust looks at a study they've done on deaths in Ohio and elsewhere related to alcohol, drugs, and suicide. And to wrap up the hour, I'll talk with Dwayne Casares, CEO of Directions for Youth and Families in Columbus, about stress endured by counselors and therapists and how they navigate feelings of being overwhelmed by their cases. First up on Columbus Perspective, joining me on the phone, State Representative Bridget Kelly. She's a Democrat from Cincinnati. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for talking to us. We're going to talk about sports gaming. It has passed in the House. You are a co-sponsor of the bill. This has been a long time coming, and it's been quite an ordeal to this point, hasn't it?
Rep Greenspan and I had our sponsor hearing over a year ago, and nine hearings later, it has passed out of the House, so we are excited to continue to move it throughout the process.
Representative Greenspan, a Republican from Cleveland. Now, there's a competing bill in the Senate, and my understanding is that the biggest difference between the two has to do with the governing body over it, right?
That's correct. So under our bill, sports gaming would be regulated by the Lottery Commission, and the money would go toward education. And we think that is really timely, particularly now, given the great need for resources for our public schools.
Okay, and the other one would have the casinos controlling it. What's the difference between the two? Why is it such a big disparity in opinions?
So in the Senate version of the bill, the money from sports gaming would go to the general revenue fund. We also believe that sports gaming is permissive under the Constitution through the Lottery Commission. And so throughout the process, you know, that structure has been vetted thoroughly, but we think there's still more discussion to be had.
And you mentioned all the hearings and the time that it has taken to this point. And time is still actually running out, right?
Correct. So if this bill doesn't make it all the way through the legislative process and isn't signed by the governor by December 31st, we'll have to start all over again. And we really think that there is an imperative to keep moving through the process as more and more states legalize sports gaming. You know, down here in Cincinnati, I often pass a billboard downtown that says, parlay and stay 20 minutes away, but 20 minutes away is another state. And so we'd really prefer that if people want to play and engage in sports gaming, that they're able to do it legally, they're able to do it here, and we can keep those resources right here in Ohio.
Talking with State Representative Bridget Kelly, a Democrat from Cincinnati, this comes too as a time when, with the pandemic, just about every entity you can think of is going to be shorthanded when it comes to funding, and this would go toward education. A part of it would.
That's true. And so, you know, this is not going to fill the entire gap that existed before the pandemic, and it certainly won't fill the gap that exists after the pandemic, but we believe these are resources right now that we are leaving on the table, or that we are forcing people to spend in other states or to take underground. Because another really important piece of this is there are no consumer protections right now, but we know that this is happening. So this would really bring the industry into the sunlight and allow us to collect some of those resources to put them where they're really needed, which is toward education.
How would this sports betting work, and what could people be betting on?
So folks could bet on, so some states have prohibited betting on college sports. Our bill does not do that. Other states have different regulations. A lot of the rules for what you'll be able to bet on are going to be promulgated by the Lottery Commission, but people will be able to bet on professional sports. Our bill also provides for mobile gaming. So we've really seen an emerging part of is an in-game bet. So, you know, who's going to catch the ball next? Is the next pitch going to be a ball or a strike. And so that is also one of the interesting challenges with this, is that this industry is just constantly changing, which is why we gave the Lottery Commission broad authority to create rules around it.
And I guess one of the aspects of it would have to do with GPS monitoring, so it would be known what state you were in and where the revenue from that goes to?
Correct. So people will have to, you know, set up an account and register, because we want to make sure only people who are legally permitted to gamble are and create accounts, so 21 and older. And we also want to make sure that folks are betting within the state border. So, you know, Ohio is landlocked by a lot of other places, and so we've seen similar technology in other states, really, where it's once you cross the state border, then you're no longer able to gamble. So if you're coming east from Indiana into Ohio, then you're not able to sports bet once you cross over that state line.
And Indiana has been doing this for a while. Have you been following that state or any other to see how it's been working?
Indiana, they raised over $25 million in April from sports betting, and there weren't really even sports happening. This is a great potential opportunity for the state of Ohio. There are 18 or 19 other states that have legalized sports gaming, and so we don't want other people traveling to other places to spend their money. We want folks to be able to do that here.
What about critics who are against perhaps even casinos, who say that it's just simply opening up another avenue to get Ohioans hooked on something that might be harmful to them?
One of the provisions of the bill actually increases the amount of resources that are specifically earmarked for problem gaming. So we think that is an important part of the bill. The other piece, though, is we know this is happening already. We know people are doing this in other states. We know people are doing this through other means. And so we want to provide consumer protections. We want to be able to provide resources to people who need them. And so really bringing this industry into the sunlight and being able to regulate it is an important step in that direction.
Talking with Representative Bridget Kelly, she's a Democrat from Cincinnati. What's your gut feeling on how these two different proposals end up combining, or one wins out over the other? How does that happen?
I think that we are really looking forward to some robust conversation over in the Senate. And if the House is any indication, we will have a large number of hearings, a lot of interested parties to come in and talk about their ideas for the bill. So I think that we're just looking forward to continuing those conversations and seeing if we can find a pathway to legalize sports gaming in Ohio and capture those resources here in our state.
Well, for folks who are in favor of such a thing, Ohio seems like about as passionate a state as there is when it comes to sports.
We have a lot of fans. Rep Greenspan and I often joke about being able to legally sports bet on which Ohio football team is going to win the Super Bowl. So hopefully we will be able to do that sooner than later.
State Representative Bridget Kelly, Democrat from Cincinnati. Anything else you'd like to add?
We really appreciate the fact that folks who've been interested in this subject have come in to testify. You know, we've held countless meetings, and we really just don't want Ohio to be left behind, particularly at a time when we need additional resources for our state. We think that, you know, bringing this industry into the sunlight, providing some consumer protections, and having some additional resources for education are really positive steps in the right direction.
Okay. Representative Kelly, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Hello, I'm Todd Markowitz, Vice President and General Manager of Radio Ohio, which owns 97.1 The Fan. We're an equal opportunity employer dedicated to providing broad outreach efforts regarding job vacancies within our company. We seek the help of local organizations in referring qualified applicants. Organizations that wish to receive our vacancy information should send their request to the attention of Human Resources, Radio Ohio, 770 Twin Rivers Drive, Columbus, 43215. If you'd like to view our current job openings, please visit our website at 971thefan.com, and thanks for listening.
Still to come on Columbus Perspective, a representative of Columbus Realtors, Policy Matters Ohio, talking about the economy. Deaths related to alcohol, drugs, and suicide via a study from Wellbeing Trust. And At about 45 minutes after the hour, Dwayne Casares, CEO of Directions for Youth and Families.
These are unprecedented times, challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency childcare, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan, courtesy of 10TV. Here is Scott Light from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Here's Scott.
Good morning, everyone. We welcome you to Face the State. I'm Scott Light. We have got a lot to get to today. Let's dive right in. Let's begin with a review of what has reopened in Ohio and testimony from Director Kim Hall as Ohio lawmakers look at what's happening with Ohio's unemployment support website and call center. We are looking into home values today. We're going to hear from the head of Columbus Realtors. Is the value of your biggest investment holding steady in this pandemic? And I spoke with Policy Matters Ohio on how Ohioans can leverage work sharing, doing that moving forward, and also what Policy Matters wants to see in a federal stimulus response the next time around from Congress. Then we have a mindful moment and an innovative way for employees to take a break during their day at work. And I promise you, you'll want it. Governor DeWine talked about nursing homes and when you can get back to finally visiting your loved ones.
We now have gone on several months, and we know that it's becoming more and more difficult for people. They've been away from their relatives. We know this has caused a great deal of heartache. We know that each facility is different, so we have allowed flexibility with the reopening guidelines. However, there's a minimum that all facilities must do. We're asking facilities to develop a policy that includes screening for temperatures and symptoms reporting for visitors. We're asking them to schedule set hours and the length of time for visits, proper social distancing measures, masks, and residents, family, and friends education about the risk of the spread of COVID-19.
The governor also spoke about how to keep employees there safe and also how each worker should be tested.
We're standing up what we're calling congregate care unified response teams. These will consist of, I believe, 10 members. We'll be up to 14 different teams. They will start testing in nursing homes this week. The National Guard will be doing the swabbing. Advanced work for this will be a combination of the local health department, our Medicaid and health departments at the state level will be involved as well. You can't get into the nursing home unless someone brings it in. The logical place where it comes in is staff, because we try to seal off basically everything else. And so testing staff makes sense from that point of view.
The governor also talked about this, wearing a mask. Is this another political issue that our country is now facing? The governor says it shouldn't be.
This is not about politics. This is not about liberal or conservative. This is not a liberal or conservative issue. This is a issue of how do I protect my neighbor? How do I protect people that I love? How do I protect people that I don't even know? And so we just need to get this beyond that this is some sort of political issue. It's not at all. It's about protecting each other. It's as old as the scriptures. You know, love your neighbor. I don't know any other way to express it. And is it perfect? No, it's not. It's not perfect. We know that. But it's another layer. And the evidence is clear. It is another layer. And so if you have the option to use another layer, why don't we just use it? And again, I think more and more Ohioans are going to continue to do this.
As our state continues to open up, some concerns are coming from employees as they worry about their safety. The governor says it all comes down to following some basics.
Where the real rubber meets the road, so to speak, is in regard to what people do every day. And you know, will they continue to keep the social distancing? I think most people will. I think most people understand in Ohio that we are in this for the long haul now. We're not twisting anybody's arm to go back to work. I mean, I think it comes down to what it's always come down to, and that is, do people, the employees, feel safe going to work? And I believe that Ohio is at the forefront in this. We're not the only state that's done it, but I think we've done a very, very good job in every single industry, every single profession, coming up with best practices. And so that that worker knows that the best practices are going to be used in their job. That best practice is put together by people who understand health, as well as people who understand that particular profession or that particular job. So that's something that we have done that we think will encourage people to feel more confident about going to work. But that is ultimately an individual decision.
We saw the director of the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services testify before the Ways and Means Committee in the Ohio State House. Director Kim Hall said this, quote, "This experience has been unlike anything we have ever witnessed. It has taken a while for some Ohioans to receive their benefits." She also offered this explanation.
"We know Ohio's quick actions flattened the curve and saved lives. However, like every other state in the nation, we experienced within our unemployment offices a surge in claims literally overnight as businesses suspended operations, and there was no time to retool our system for the historic onslaught."
Still, some members of the Ohio House weren't satisfied.
"When you took office in January, you and your staff knew, you knew the system in the computer system that we're all complaining about today did not work well. It did not provide good customer service. You knew it was an ancient system. And your department and yourself knew we were years away from the new system being available. So my question is to you, knowing that a solution is a couple years off, why didn't you take prudent steps, you and your staff, to at least improve and update the current system that every Ohioan has to live with for the next couple years?" The department has been overwhelmed by phone calls, and that's a problem. But that's really not the root problem. The system is designed to work electronically and to have people submit claims electronically and basically to seamlessly move electronically. So the question is, why have there been so many phone calls? And from what I have heard from my constituents and other folks is that the online system that we're effectively mandated to go through and encouraged to go through is broken, and it's very difficult to navigate, thus necessitating the reason for thousands of calls to the department, because the department's website is effectively broken. So your department says, well, we can't help it because we're getting so many phone calls. Well, the reason you're getting so many phone calls is because your website's broken.
Still to come this morning, your home and the pandemic. We're going to dive into how the Central Ohio real estate market is doing with a central question. How's the value of your biggest investment holding up?
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors. Back to Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back. In this pandemic, there is a lot of news out there with data and numbers going down. Maybe your investments, your bank account, if you're out of work, and the overall tanking of the American economy. So let's bring some perspective on what is likely still your biggest investment, your home. New numbers out show home sales taking a double-digit dip, but median prices and sales prices are still going up. I talked with Michael Jones about this, president-elect of Columbus Realtors.
Is our biggest investment, our home, is that still a good, safe investment in Central Ohio?
Absolutely. I think that, again, as evidenced by the number of people that have been disadvantaged or put in a bad position with this pandemic and being out of work, we've seen or come to realize that everybody has to live somewhere. Certainly trying to work and budget yourself accordingly, you don't have to spend more. We don't encourage people to spend more than what they can actually afford. But owning your home is a huge step towards wealth, personal wealth, a stability, if you will. And there's nothing safer, I don't think, than investing in real estate. We had some unique times in 2008, 2009, and I don't think that those were as much of an indicator of real estate not being a stable investment as much as it was some things that dealt with other segments or portions of our industry. So I think real estate continues to be a strong opportunity to build wealth, independent wealth for each individual homeowner, as well as just creating stability for our community.
Let's get into the numbers. As for home sales in the month of April, homes under $350,000 sold on average in 25 days. Columbus Realtors says that number even surprised them.
In April, the sales were in recovery, I'd say, for the most part. Average sales year over year were 3.4% to 6.6%. So average sales prices, I should say. So that's very positive. Sales and new listings actually slowed, but to the extent that you might hear outside of Central Ohio, where they slowed very significantly. For example, sales were down nationally by 17.2%. For the month of March to April, that time frame, and specifically Columbus or the Central Ohio market was only down 6.3% in the Columbus region for that exact same time period. We're down year over year by 15% from March to April, from 2019 to 2020. But generally, as you might expect, people were sheltering in place, so we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. But as you compare it to the national statistics, we certainly did much better than our counterparts throughout the country.
Why do you think we did fare better than counterparts throughout the rest of the country?
There are a number of different factors. So as you look into 2020, the forecast lens, there were indicators that suggested that we might be looking at a recession. Ohio in general, and Columbus more specifically, will tend to fare better, we expected, in a recession. And so by the same token, even during this pandemic, pre-lockdown, during lockdown, and post-lockdown, we continue to do a little bit better than the performers throughout the United States. And it didn't hurt, certainly, that the governor, in his wisdom, deemed us an essential service. So we had a huge impact there. An interesting story to kind of share with you. In Ohio, we represented approximately, I have these numbers, about $55,000 per home sold as a contribution, which is about 14.8% of the gross state product. And that can include anything from, you know, the costs that go into helping somebody buy or sell a home to the things that actually go into the home. So at 14.8% in 2019, it's definitely an indicator that we have a huge impact. Real estate sales has a huge impact.
And anytime you talk Central Ohio real estate, you got to mention one word in particular. Inventory. Our market has stayed red hot the last several years because demand has been high and inventory has stayed low.
How is that corrected? Is that a combination of government policy? Is this just getting more builders here to Central Ohio? What do we do about our inventory issues?
Well, I think building new construction is a huge component of that. There are several factors that slow that process. There is some government regulation that slows that significantly. And there are things that are being put in place to help improve that. There has been, you know, the builders are coming out of still some economic recovery themselves. And being able to build an affordable product while still leaving room for margins, et cetera, is a huge challenge. So it's really a part of that. It's a part of people knowing where they can go before they put a house on the market. There are a number of different factors that play into that decision. How do we increase inventory? One of the biggest factors, I would say, is new construction. We're way behind if you look at how some of the analysts have seen it. I mean, to the tune of, for some of our peer cities, maybe nearly 15 to 20%, which is pretty significant.
So let's stay on the subject of numbers, because numbers are people. Hannah Halbert at Policy Matters Ohio said that one-fifth of working people in Ohio have lost their jobs in this pandemic. They also say there are two solutions to recovering them, beginning with work sharing.
Work sharing, what a great program. It's a win for workers and a win for employers. And this is a program that's housed at Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. And what work share does is allow a business to save jobs, retain employees. So an employer can spread the reduction of hours that it needs in its workforce across a group of employees. So it can spread the hours that are available across many employees. So you can share the work instead of just taking out those hours by laying off a smaller group of workers. So if I have 50 employees and I need to reduce my hours by a fifth, maybe because of demand or because I need to stagger when people come in and out of the office, I need to have that reduction of labor force. Well, I can lay off 10 folks, or I can reduce the work week to 4 hours a week. So folks can stay on the job, can stay connected to work. I keep the workforce I have intact, and those workers can make a partial claim on unemployment. So they're making up some of that lost income, and they're eligible for the $600 pandemic unemployment compensation supplement. So it works for employers, it helps them meet their actual needs for their workforce, and it works for workers because people aren't facing a complete loss of income during this time. So that's available, that's a real solution. Many people across the state are taking advantage of it. The state could do much more to promote this as an option, especially as we're hearing employers start to be concerned about workers coming back. And we're trying all kinds of ways to solve that problem when we have a real solution right here that works for workers and the employers.
Hannah Halbert also told me another solution has to come from the federal government, another stimulus. And she agrees with some other economists who say this: the next phase of stimulus has to go to people and cities first, not corporations or entire industries.
The needs aren't going away. I think people are feeling this real slog of this process now. We have a lot of focus on reopening, and it does feel like people have forgotten about the urgency, how Ohio families, how people are really suffering. And we are going to start seeing the next wave of things as bills become due, eviction courts start opening up again. We're going to see these new challenges. One way of thinking about this, and really, you know, what I hope will encourage our federal lawmakers to sort of rise to this challenge is really think about the why this matters. We're going to be thinking about kids coming back into schools. Their needs are not diminishing. They're growing during this crisis. We're going to need people to clean the schools, clean the classrooms, figure out virtual classroom training, provide that support to teachers. The needs are growing during this time. And if we don't get that right, not only are we going to prolong the suffering of this current economic crisis, we're going to be setting ourselves up for worse down the road.
When we come back, an Ohio architectural firm designing something very unique. And once we explain, you're going to say, man, I want that where I work.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Back to Scott Light, courtesy of 10TV.
Welcome back. Every Tuesday and Thursday during our 5 p.m. newscasts, we air a segment called Mindful Moment. There is an avalanche of research pouring in every day all over the world on the subject of mindfulness. In fact, Ohio State University is leaning into this with groundbreaking research on mindfulness practices for Wexner Medical Center doctors. The hope being a more mindful doctor means a better health outcome for you, and they are seeing those results. So I heard from viewers at MA Architects. They built something in their office called a respite room.
Actually, we started talking about this when we had a need internally for ourselves. We were trying to be a little proactive about it. Our office here is about 18,000 square feet. We have about 80 people. And we realized that with an open office concept of about 95% open office, we really didn't have a space for people to have a mental break, which we know is very important. So we started with this team and a few others collaborating on what this room would look like and what the needs are. And I'll let Mark talk a little bit more about the room in specific, but we integrated it into our office and realized, you know, this need probably expands a lot further than just our office and certainly workplace.
Their firm definitely hit on something. And in this pandemic, it has only heightened that need for a mental break at work. So now, MA is designing respite rooms for more than 10 clients, including 3 rooms for OSU School of Nursing.
A big thing is the World Health Organization predicts that depression will be the leading healthcare concern by 2030. And COVID has definitely expedited that. I think stigma to strength is our big tagline for mental health for MA. It's a huge priority for us. And we've definitely seen that catalyst of change through COVID, really prioritizing mental health, because people who maybe have not had experiences with it before are having feelings and going through situations that they've never really experienced. These feelings of anxiety, of depression, what that intensity feels like on the nervous system when you're just overloaded with stress. So having these rooms of literal respite where you can take a break, regain calm, you know, really support your central nervous system, it's important now more than ever. And to Carrie's point, with the respite room concept starting at our office and now growing out to our clients, it was us really trying to be proactive as opposed to reactive.
We really just wanted to start looking into what stress was on the body and really understanding how chronic stress affects us, you know, how it leads to higher blood pressure, how it leads to lower immune systems. And so looking into all of that research, we then started to look into the other like evidence-based design research techniques that are out there in terms of color theory and lighting. You know, dappled lighting is a huge thing that actually activates something in the brain chemistry that allows a sense of calming for the central nervous system, because it harkens back to when, you know, we were on the plains of the Serengeti and we were sitting underneath a tree. So it really goes to like our reptilian brain aspect. And so we wanted to take a lot of those ideas and principles that have been researched and thought of and implemented into this room. And then once we realized that, again, it was something that we could use in our office, we really wanted to see how we could use it going forward. And we're implementing it on all of our workplace projects pretty much going forward. We're actually starting to create some standards around it and then hoping to do some primary research around it as well.
The folks at MA also realized, hey, the general public can't swing a respite room build out on their house. So they put out ways that you can create one in your own home, and it doesn't have to be complicated at all.
Doesn't. I think the key is that it has to be away from your everyday activity. So if you have a home office set up, you don't want it to be in that same space. It needs to truly be a respite and a getaway, making sure that the lighting is correct and there's no other sound distractions, and it truly is a calming, safe space.
And one of the big differentiators, the evidence-based design is huge. We also used consultants from Ohio State University, the National Institute of Health, and even yoga instructors when we constructed this room and all of its contents. And the huge, huge differentiator is sensory tools. So we have STIM tools available inside of the room that support the central nervous system. So they actually calm the sympathetic nervous system, decreasing your stress hormones, cortisone, and adrenaline. And they increase a sense of calm and mindfulness. So the room is really rooted in research. It's far beyond just your classic room that's, you know, the quiet room off to the corner that might have a yoga mat inside.
So now, as people get back to the office and your boss asks, okay, so what can we do differently in and after this pandemic? Now you have a great idea to bring some peace and calm to work. Stay safe, everyone. Stay healthy. And thanks for joining us this week.
180 over 111, and I had a stroke. 145 over 92, and then I had a heart attack.
150 over 90, and I had a stroke.
This is what high blood pressure sounds like. You might not feel its symptoms, but the results from a heart attack or stroke are far from silent. Get back on your treatment plan or talk with your doctor to create a plan that works for you. Go to loweryourhbp.org.
Everything's changed.
Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
And this is becoming quite the battle. The 2-2 pitch on the way.
With the support of Major League Baseball, Stand Up To Cancer is fighting to end cancer.
Hit high, hit deep.
And we won't stop until...
it's gone!
Stand up for the 16 million people living with cancer in the U.S. and Canada. Join us at standuptocancer.org/MLB.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Coming up in about 10 minutes, Dwayne Casares, CEO of Directions for Youth and Families. But first, joining me on the phone, Ben Miller. He's the Chief Strategy Officer at Wellbeing Trust. How are you?
I'm well, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for talking to us. Tell us what Wellbeing Trust is.
Wellbeing Trust is a national foundation focused on advancing the mental, social, spiritual health of the nation. We've been around about 4 years now and are doing our best to help address mental health across the country.
Okay, and you and the Trust for America's Health are out with your Pain in the Nation report, an update on alcohol, drug, and suicide deaths from 2018.
That's correct. I wish there were more joyful things to talk about with you today, but yes, we've been doing this report on an annual basis, looking at what we call the deaths of despair, deaths to drug, alcohol, and suicide, and really looking at how those deaths have fared over time. And the latest report, the one that you're referencing that just came out, shows some improvements in this country. We're actually doing a better job addressing some aspects of these deaths of despair, but sadly, they're still too high. There's still too many people losing lives to preventable causes.
You look at the total, alcohol, drugs, and suicide, about 150,000 nationwide in 2018, a little over 7,000 of those in Ohio. Obviously, big numbers that we're talking about.
Yeah, they're big numbers. And I think one of the things that's extremely troubling about reports like this is that we can become desensitized to the data. The numbers are so big and so in our face that sometimes we forget that behind each one of those numbers is a person, is a family, is a friend. And I think it's a call to action for us. We use it as a motivating tool to improve. And while these data do show some improvement, Ohio specifically, it looks like you've made some great progress around opioids. You've done some great work around alcohol. You still have work to do around suicide, which I think is consistent with where most of the country is.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I compared Ohio with Illinois, pretty similar population. Illinois just very slightly larger, but not significantly. 1,838 suicides in Ohio, 1,488 in Illinois. That statistically is a huge difference.
It is, and it's actually one of the factors that we consider when we look at data such as these. Now, this report does not get into the why, but if you read deeper, there are some aspects here that we know have been plaguing some of our communities since 2008, since the Great Recession. Those are issues of economic unemployment, looking at how to bring back some of those low-skilled jobs that we know really do make a difference in keeping people alive.
I guess the problem now, too, is, you know, with what's going on, who knows what the impact is going to be down the line, but it can't be good.
Well, that's true. I think the one thing to note is that uncertainty is definitely can take us down a place of fear and dread, and we're not sure what's going to happen because of COVID. Sheltering in place has wreaked all kinds of havoc on our social issues, including being lonely and isolated. But I think that we have to use this as a moment to really reflect on the things that are working and not, and to pursue strategies that are going to be much more beneficial for our communities, strategies that really take into account mental health and addiction needs. That's our call to action, and I think now is a great time to embrace that.
Talking with Ben Miller from Wellbeing Trust, so what are some of the programs and recommendations that you're making?
Yeah, so a couple of them that we call out is, number one, we think that we've got to do a better job investing in prevention. being proactively engaged and identifying issues before they become problems is something that we have not, as a nation, really done well. We don't invest in public health infrastructure. We haven't put a lot of money into primary prevention. So that's one area that we call out. We can do a much better job there. Another area that we call out is that we've got to make it easier to identify and treat mental health wherever people show up. Whether that's your primary care doctor's office or your school, wherever it might be, we should make sure that there are policies and financial mechanisms that support the inclusion of mental health into those places.
I noticed in one of the recommendations, too, you talked about homophobia. And I know that teens who are either gay or transsexual, the suicide rates are extremely high for them.
Yeah, there's some troubling trends that I think we see here. And I think it speaks to a much deeper need for our country to have hard conversations around acceptance and around change. And what you see with our youth are some troubling trends. But I think that what we have to do is to embrace the fact that each of us needs to be supported, comforted, and in many cases just loved, no matter what our sexual identity might be, no matter what the color of our skin is. This report is also a call for us to just be there for one another and to embrace each other and to support each other in ways that truly are the most impactful.
Another one of the statistics I looked at comparing states that are similar, Ohio and Pennsylvania, alcohol deaths. Ohio, 1,220 alcohol deaths in 2018, 931 in Pennsylvania, which has a larger population. Could state policy even be behind some of those numbers?
It could. I mean, we know that there are policies that definitely help reduce alcohol consumption. Alcohol is a tricky one because the alcohol, unlike some of the opioids, doesn't just automatically kill you because you took too much of it. I mean, in some extreme cases, it can.
Right.
But really, alcohol is more of a long-term use and seeing that play out over years. So you're catching up to a lot of folks that might have been drinking too much over the course of their lives. And actually, I believe that some of the deaths that you might see in these data could actually have started from some of the 2008-2009 economic downturn and are just now catching up to them with their chronic disease. But yes, there are policies that people could pursue today to address and decrease some of the issues around alcohol.
Are there any geographical trends involved in these statistics?
Yeah, I think it's what's interesting about these data is that there's obviously always going to be geographical variation between rural and urban, east versus west, north versus south. But I think what we see and some of the trends that stay strong is that in communities that were most impacted by the recession, most impacted by the economic downturn, those are communities that are having a harder time coming back. And the jobs aren't there as much, which means that there's more despair. The economic opportunities just simply aren't as robust as we would like them to be. So sadly, I think some of the states and some of the communities and some of the counties that have had ongoing issues around deaths of despair still need a little bit more assistance there. That's part of the reason why we call for the need to invest more and just a one-size-fits-all approach. We actually need to be tailoring a lot of the solutions to local communities, whether that be communities of color or communities that have lost their jobs or whatever it might be. We do believe that there has to be more that we can do to address specific communities with unique plans.
Talking with Ben Miller, Chief Strategy Officer, Wellbeing Trust, you've got a very comprehensive report online. Where can folks find this, Ben?
Yeah, the easiest way to find out information about the report is go to paininthenation.org. You can see the previous reports that we put out. You can pull down information specific to Ohio. And most importantly, you can look at the solutions that we believe are so promising.
Great. Ben Miller again, Wellbeing Trust. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Absolutely, Dave. Thanks for covering the topic.
This next segment with Dwayne Casares from Directions for Youth and Families was recorded several months ago before the pandemic. This is Columbus Perspective on Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Hi, this is Dave James. Joining me in the studio is the Chief Executive Officer of Directions for Youth and Families. It's Dwayne Casares. How you doing, Dwayne?
I like the D. It's kind of like, like the Ohio State University. This should just be a trend for anybody in Columbus. This is what we should be.
And I dropped the CEO and gave the actual name.
Oh,
yeah. In case anybody didn't know what that stood for.
Yeah. I'm sure that you would find different words for those letters, Dave.
I'm sure.
I'm surprised you did not. You know what? You're maturing. This is great.
Well, I'm sure that the CEO is loosely interpreted where you are.
I'm sure they call you things other than chief executive officer.
That's a good thing, Ray's in East Toledo. These things don't bother us.
Well, what this place where people do call you names, what is it exactly? What do they do there? What is it?
They, besides call me names, is that what you're suggesting,
right,
Dave?
Yeah.
We're a nonprofit mental health agency. We also have after school and summer programs. We have over 75 licensed therapists. They all do outreach work, so they work with kids and families out in the community, in their homes and in schools or community environments. And a lot of that is just to break down barriers of transportation, childcare. We believe everybody should be able to access services and not have those barriers. About 96% of all of our services are free. So it's a we cover the full gamut of mental and behavioral health services with full diagnostic assessments. We have psychiatric psychological services. And then, of course, our after school and summer programs, which have music, dance, art, leadership programs, computer helps, tutoring programs, all kinds of things.
Now, the last part sounded like fun. The earlier part sounded kind of stressful.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they both can be, because even with the after-school centers, although we've been able to really cultivate, you know, very healthy cultures there amongst the kids, we still deal with people who live in toxic stress environments, and that carries an awful lot of weight. You know, we deal with an awful lot of kids who have to parent in their own home, even though they are still kids. Some of the things that come with challenging high-risk communities, you know, when you talk about gang activities and drugs and poverty and homelessness, all these are factors that we end up having to work with our kids.
As far as the people on your staff who see this all the time and have to help navigate a kid or a family through these kind of dire circumstances, that's got to be tough on them. And I guess we brought this up because there was a story that came out not long ago where it said that 53% of Ohio's children's services caseworkers have symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. That's incredible.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised by that statistic. It's when you look at these types of things, I always tell people, you know, walking in and out of people's lives is serious business, and far be it for any of us to create more damage that was there before they came through our door. So that requires an awful lot of parameters to put around these types of things. But also, no one has this endless vat of empathy. And as much as we preach in the field about boundaries, and boundaries are there to protect clients, are also there to protect the workers just because of some of the things we work with. I mean, some of our programs, children of murdered parents and siblings. Now think about having to work with that population every day. Our Promises programs are for survivors of sexual abuse. And think about working with that population every day. This is going to take some wear and tear on any person. Regardless of how many boundaries and parameters they put in place to protect themselves, we openly tell workers, particularly new workers, if you come into this field, there is going to be a loss of innocence. And unfortunately, it's not something you're going to get back. So we try to do as much as we can to protect that.
It makes me think of, you know, when somebody first becomes a cop, they must be thinking, watching for everybody going through a rolling stop or everybody who's going 2 miles an hour over the speed limit. Oh my God, this is my job to take care of this stuff. And, and you know, as you go on and on over time, you learn what's important and what's not. Is it kind of like that with some of this?
Are you suggesting rolling stops aren't important?
No, not at all. Not me, officer, no.
I would have had you pay for my ticket that I got 2 years ago, Dave. I'll pull that up from where I have it, and you can reimburse me. Yeah, you know, it's a little bit different just because of the fact rolling stops are all rolling stops. We deal with human beings, and each one of them comes with its unique set of variables, and you have to move into. So although there may be many people who are struggling with the same issue, depression isn't manifested the same way it is across every person. Anxiety is not manifested the same. So you have to be constantly adjusting and starting where that person is at. It's something that's big in the social work field. You start where the client's at. So we have to go through all of that first before you can even start to even treat and start to work through some of these issues. So it's a constant challenge. Rolling stops look all the same, in a sense. The people we serve, regardless of diagnosis, do not. They come in total different packages. We work with individuals, not objects. And that changes the game.
Does a caseworker, is there guilt sometimes involved, or, you know, just sort of a feeling of helplessness? What are some of the things that go on?
And that's actually a great question, because that's what separates personal from professional. And we're not glorified bartenders. You just don't go in there and talk to somebody and have to process that. So keeping boundaries about that. Here's the whole deal. When a person that we work with, a client, is successful, you have to be very, very careful. And we train all of our workers on this, and we openly talk about these types of things. The celebration of their success is theirs. And we got to remember that. They did the work. We just went along for the ride and assisted them, but they're the ones who did the work. All change is tough. So they had the hard work. So let's celebrate that. And here's why that's critical. If you think that you're going to start taking credit for every kid or every family that ends up being successful, you're also probably going to take credit for every kid in every family that fails. We are very big, and we don't tell people what to do. We give them choices. We explore what avenues they can go. We allow them to make that decision, and then we work through it with them, because they're the ones who have to live with their decisions. It is their choice. It is their decision, and then it's their responsibility. So you have to have some parameters around that, some boundaries around that to separate those.
Talking with Dwayne Cassara, CEO, Directions for Youth and Families. Empathy at a distance? Is that maybe one way to look at
that's the tricky part, because it can't be at a distance. You know, half the work in our field really is engagement. And if you cannot engage a person, mm-hmm. I don't care how gifted of a therapist you think you are, you're probably not going to be as successful. So you have to be able to engage them. And that can't come across as false, or empathy as a distance. But it certainly has to come within parameters of practice guidelines. And, you know, all of us that are licensed have ethical codes of where you have to keep boundaries around certain things to make sure you don't violate those things. It's one of the critical things about transference. I always look at new people when they come in and I'm interviewing them. You say, well, why did you come into this field? I'm a people person. I like helping people. Everybody, when I was going through high school, would come to me with problems. And I think that's all fine and dandy. And I think certainly, as a core, you want somebody who wants to help other people.
Sure.
But if you think that's enough, you're going to get burnout within a year, and then you're not serving anybody. So that's the whole professional part of it, is to be able, we use things like motivational interviewing, which helps then engage a person and pull them in. We look at patterns of interaction. What style of how people interact with their external environment, that gives us clues. So we're constantly assessing. It gives us clues as to how we can engage this person so we can start to be a part of the helping process.
But for a new therapist or counselor, it must be common for them to go to somebody with more experience and say, I'm in a situation here where I don't know how I'm supposed to feel about this or what I'm supposed to do about it.
And we have to do that. Actually, before we even send anybody out in the field, they spend 4 months shadowing other workers. They have to learn from these things. And we make it very clear. I tell everyone, every orientation class that comes in, look, folks, you're all going to screw up. You're going to. And not only are you going to, you have my permission to do so. Now, don't violate laws or things like that. But, you know, people are going to make, because of the number of variables with each individual, you're not going to know everything that you need to know. We need people in this field of good character. A person of good character isn't somebody who does everything right. A person of good character, you actually see what happens after they screw up. You know, they can dismiss it, they can project it, they can blame it, they can rationalize it, they can intellectualize it. There's 15 basic defense mechanisms. I think we've talked about those before. Many of them are considered primitive because humans are so good at them. So you can do any of those things, or you can take responsibility for it, acknowledge it, correct what you can, and then choose to learn from it. You're in a constant state of learning. Those are people of good character.
If somebody who is a counselor or a therapist gets to the point where they're overwhelmed, and let's say they go into a sort of a depression, maybe mm-hmm. more than just a funk, are they good at identifying that within themselves? Because, you know, a lot of times you hear about how doctors are the worst patients.
Yeah, sometimes it's really hard to see, but, you know, that's why you have supervisors. That's why you have team leads, at least in our structure, to see those things. We really push an environment of support versus an environment of surveillance to keep those things open. It's a responsibility of all of us to point these things out. Self-care is huge. It is a initiative that I think people in the human service field, agencies, need to be very intentional about in creating self-care components within the structures of their own environment. So we're in the process of doing that. We have a somatic room in one of our centers. We are exploring many options to put these into every one of our centers so that when workers can come back, if they need a place to go, a quiet place to decompress and to really center and balance themselves, then that's what they can do. It's also helpful to be able to do that before you go home. You don't want to take these things out on the people who are closest to you.
Talking with Dwayne Cassara, CEO, Directions for Youth and Families. Just a couple of minutes to go here. So broadening that out to everybody, because we all have stress.
Yes.
What are some of the best ways for people to, if they identify that in a spouse or somebody in the house, to help them through that?
You know, one of the things is there's many different kinds of, and I put this in quotes, therapy. So certainly therapy is one thing anybody can benefit from, I think. And it's not a bad word. Actually, if anything, I believe it takes courage to acknowledge these things and then to choose to do something about it. Again, I think that is a person of character because they acknowledge that deficit or that need and then choose to reach out for it. And that's a very mature response to it. But there's also many different kinds of therapy. You know, sometimes people get, you know, freaked out about therapy. You know, there's self-help books. There are self-help groups that aren't necessarily therapeutic, but you know, one of the things I always tell people too, if you surround yourself by healthy people, that's ongoing therapy. If you truly have a social network or a family unit that is very supportive of each other and caring and listens to each other, that is a form of therapy. Because whenever we look at people high in stress, even when we work with clients, we look at what their support system is. And in that support system, that's what you want. This is what people do on a daily basis. So there's all kinds of therapy, if you will, that people can get. What you don't want to do is ignore it and think it's going to go away. That typically does not happen. I also think it's important you understand the culture in what you're working in or the morale of that agency and how much do they pay attention to these types of components of self-care. Because you spend most of your awake time getting ready for work, at work, or winding down from work. You better make sure it's a healthy place. You better make sure it's a place that is not going to totally drain you and then leave you empty. That's what culture is about, and you want to make sure that there at least is a focus on that, if you will.
A few months ago, we talked about how a few years ago, we both happened to mention before we were rolling on the air, how we had kind of abandoned music in our adulthood, and both had reconnected with it
right
since then, which is also kind of a type of therapy.
Music, journaling. I mean, just journal. If you gave yourself three positive affirmations each day and said them to yourself in the mirror every morning and then checked at the end of the day, did I stick to these three positive affirmations? That alone, Dave, can do tremendous things for individuals because you start and end your day with something that's more on a positive note. Yeah, music is great. It's many people get benefits. You should have people exercise. I go to the gym in the morning. It people run. I don't understand those people. you know, there's just many things you can do. There's hobbies. There should be escapes that you end up being able to enjoy things.
Getting hooked on reality TV.
Okay. Now I'm going to push back on that one, Dave. I don't know if listening to people scream at each other and play out dysfunctional behaviors that are like axis 2 cluster B personality disorders is the best thing. It's one of the things with some reality TV I think can be fun. But when I see all the screaming and yelling on some of these, it's like, oh, no, I don't need to introduce
stuff can make the plants around your house wilt.
I'm not entertained by that. So.
Dwayne Cassara, he's CEO Directions for Chief Executive Officer, the Chief Executive Officer of Directions for
See, here's part of my self-help. I come and see you, Dave. That hurts my self-care.
If folks want more info about your agency, where do they find it?
They can check us out on the web, www.dfyf.org, or then call our intake department, 614-294-2661.
All righty. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Dave.
This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM. That's 1460 ESPN Columbus. And Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM. Sports Radio 97.1 The Fan. Join us again next Sunday for Columbus Perspective.